Here in the third hour of Issues Etc., we're going to spend some time talking with Dr. Russell Moore. He joins us first to talk about abortion and the human conscience. Then, a little later in this hour, Eric Johnson of Mormonism Research Ministry joins us to talk about a resolution passed by the Illinois legislature that accepted blame for the, quote, inhospitable actions taken against the Mormon people in the mid-19th century. We'll round off this third hour of the program today talking with Stephanie Gray of the Center for Bioethical Reform. You may have seen them. They're box trucks driving around St. Louis and in other key states with pictures of aborted babies on them. The CBR is sponsoring this pro-life caravan called the Key State Initiative. We'll talk with her about that in the last part of this third hour of Issues Etc. Dr. Russell Moore is our guest right now. He's Dean of the School of Theology and Assistant Professor of Theology at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. He's author of the forthcoming book, The Kingdom of Christ, The New Evangelical Perspective. And he's also written a recent column for Baptist Press titled, Aborting the Conscience. Dr. Moore, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd. Good to be with you.
Tell us the story that you found in the New York Times Magazine, actually a commentary there, that sparked this latest of your columns.
Well, it was a back page commentary in the New York Times Magazine in which a young woman tells about her finding herself pregnant with triplets and the decision that she made to abort two of the babies and to keep one. And she gives the reasons behind that decision, among which are the fact that she did not want to climb the stairs at her apartment building, and that she did not want to be, as she puts it, one of these women buying the great big vats of mayonnaise at Costco.
Now, you said while that commentary itself was a bit bone-chilling, the responses from the letters to the editor were even more so. Tell us about
that. Well, the responses were interesting because you had some people writing letters saying, we applaud her courage and we applaud her bravery. But you had many other letters in which people, even those who claimed to be pro-choice on abortion, were very uncomfortable at the motives behind her decision to abort two of these babies. It just doesn't, as one letter writer said, it doesn't have the kind of awe and wonder that one ought to have in making a decision about abortion. And I remember putting down the letters to the editor and asking, now, why should there be awe and wonder if abortion is simply the evacuation of a piece of tissue?
Now, this brings up the question of the conscience. We talked recently with Jay Bujaszewski. He's from the University of Texas. He teaches philosophy and government there. Several books, one called The Revenge of Conscience, the other most recently called What We Can't Not Know. And he uses abortion as an example. He says the advocates of abortion are repressing a conscience that really can't be repressed. The conscience is taking revenge, and that's where their advocacy sometimes is grounded. What do you think?
Well, I think you see this even in the woman who wrote this commentary piece. You know, the New York Times had to come back and apologize to its readers several weeks later and announce that this young lady who had written this piece is actually a paid activist with Planned Parenthood. This is not just some objective storytelling. There's an agenda behind this on her part. But I think what's happening in terms of the abortion issue, you have everyone going into an abortion clinic experiencing guilt and grief of some kind or another. And the question is, why? Why is it that someone who writes out a check to Planned Parenthood every month gets uncomfortable reading about a story of a woman who would abort babies in order not to have to buy big vats of mayonnaise at Costco? Well, I think it's because we all know, deep within our hearts, it's written in the law, written in the hearts, that this is not just tissue that's being done away with. This is a human being. You can't, as Jay Bujaszewski would say, you can't not know that. And you see that, I think, even with our politicians, the way that they speak. They talk about arguing for a woman's right to choose, but they never tell you to choose what. It's choice. I'm pro-choice. But they never go on to talk about, well, what is this abortion? What is actually taking place?
The language that is used, you mentioned that, sometimes the euphemisms or just the clear omissions in our language that are used in this debate, especially those who advocate for abortion, are they designed to, what, soothe the conscience or stave off the accusations of the conscience?
They're trying to soothe the conscience, but they fail. And that's why you see things like in some abortion clinics, there will be signs on the wall that say things like, please do not bring small children into this clinic. It disturbs the other patients. Why does it disturb the other patients? It's because it's a reminder of exactly what is taking place in this clinic, and no one wants to think about that. And so what's happening here is precisely what the Apostle Paul talks about in Romans chapter 1. It's a suppressing of the truth. You really aren't finding people out there who just don't have any concept that abortion might be wrong. We all know that it's wrong. My 3-year-old son looked at a cover of a magazine with a very, very early fetus, to use contemporary lingo, on it, and I asked him, "What is this?" And his response was, "It's a baby." And he's 3 years old. He knows that. That's built into us as creatures in the image of God.
You have written this, Dr. Moore, and I'd like you to explain it a little bit further. The conscience for the unbeliever is not Jiminy Cricket offering a welcomed guide from within. Mm-hmm. Instead, it is a universal gnawing within the heart that points to a coming judgment which men and women desperately want to deny exists at all.
And that's what the Apostle Paul writes to the church at Rome. He says that when the Gentiles do the things that the law demands, they demonstrate that they know that there is a law, and their conscience is condemning them in the coming judgment. So the people that we're trying to evangelize, we're not trying to convince them that there's a judgment. They know that there's a judgment. They know that there's a law, but they don't want to respond to it. There's an interesting article in City Journal a couple of months ago talking about how you can see a real moral sense on the Jerry Springer program. You turn on Jerry Springer, if you dare, and watch it, and you will see people using moral discourse. He did that to me, and he shouldn't have. She did that to me, and she shouldn't have. And the question inevitably rises for Christians, where do these people on Jerry Springer get that sense of right and wrong? They can't explain it, but we can.
We're talking about abortion and the human conscience. Dr. Russell Moore is our guest. He is Dean of the School of Theology and Assistant Professor of Theology at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. He has written a recent column for Baptist Press titled Aborting the Conscience. You also point out in this column that modern evangelical preaching has an Achilles heel. Tell us what you mean.
Well, I think that so much of our preaching doesn't address the conscience at all. Instead, it addresses the self-interest of the hearers. And so we'll say things like, come to Jesus and you will have peace and joy and happiness, and that's true, at least in some sense. Or we'll address people trying to warn them that they really don't want to spend eternity in hell, which is also true. But what we're bypassing there is what the New Testament tells us that Jesus and the apostles do, which is presenting the Word of God so that the Spirit can convict men and women of sin, righteousness, and judgment. We're not appealing to the conscience. And so what needs to take place in preaching in our evangelical churches is to stand up and address people who know that they are condemned and who are trying to whistle past the judgment seat, if you will, and appeal to that conscience and seek to pierce through it with the Word.
What does Scripture mean when it refers to the conscience as being seared?
Well, I think it means that human beings want to paper it over and paper it over and paper it over, not listening to it, for such a long period of time that they eventually become dull to the conscience. They have a seared, calloused over conscience to which they can no longer hear. I think that's what Paul is dealing with in Romans chapter 1 when he talks about God giving us over. So someone, for instance, you think of a man in a congregation who is involved in internet pornography, who feels very, very guilty about it at the very beginning, and who starts to feel less and less guilty about it as time goes on. That should not be an encouragement to him. That should be a terrifying phenomenon.
So it would seem that the conscience then for the preacher of God's Word, the preaching of both the law which convicts of sin and the gospel which shows us our Savior in Jesus Christ, has in both the unbeliever and the believer an ally in the conscience.
Absolutely, because as Paul tells us in Romans 2, the conscience is pointing us to the judgment. And so when you have a conscience that is condemning you, what do? You fly to Christ. You go to Christ in order to soothe that conscience that you cannot quiet in any other way. And so really, you have people, this young woman who wrote this column, I have nothing but sadness as I read this, because this is a young woman who is trying to justify herself on the pages of the New York Times. And unless she comes to Christ, she will be doing that exact same thing on her deathbed. That really ought to break our hearts.
And just so that we make sure that God's Word speaks properly to every condition of the sinful heart. This is something that Christians can speak of from experience. We are also masters at self-justification, sinners that we are.
That's exactly right. Every one of us have been doing that, and apart from God's grace, do it still.
Dr. Russell Moore is Dean of the School of Theology and Assistant Professor of Theology at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. He is author of a forthcoming book, The Kingdom of Christ, The New Evangelical Perspective, and he's also written a recent column for Baptist Press titled Aborting the Conscience. Dr. Moore, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Now, you can read Dr. Moore's weekly column on the web. It's at sbcbaptistpress.org, sbcbaptistpress, all one word, .org. In a moment here, we're going to start a conversation with Eric Johnson. You may not have been aware of this, but the Illinois legislature passed a resolution that accepted blame for the, quote, inhospitable actions taken against the Mormon people in the mid-19th century. You are certainly aware that the Mormons did, in the course of their brief beginning history, make a trek-a line through the state of Illinois. We're going to find out about that. And we'll find out about this resolution passed by the Illinois legislature in just a moment with Eric Johnson of Mormonism Research Ministry. Then, in the last 20 minutes of the program or so, Stephanie Gray will join us, a media spokesman for the Center for Bioethical Reform. Now, you may or may not have seen these, but there are panel trucks, box trucks, driving around St. Louis with pictures of aborted babies prominently displayed. What are they up to? What is this about? Well, the Center for Bioethical Reform is sponsoring this pro-life caravan called the Key States Initiative. We'll find out what they hope to. Well, first of all, why they think it's important to display the gruesome pictures and what they hope to accomplish by putting them on trucks and putting them on the highways. Eric Johnson is associate with the Mormonism Research Ministry. He's co-author of the book Mormonism 101. He's author of a story in the Christian Research Journal titled Illinois Regrets Inhospitable Actions Against Mormon Church. Eric, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Well, thanks for having me.
Tell us what were the inhospitable actions that were taken, supposedly according to this action of the Illinois legislature, and what did they actually say about these actions?
Well, what happened in the 1840s, Joseph Smith was killed at the Carthage jail in 1844, in June of 1844. And after that time, there were a number of things that were happening politically. And after he was murdered, the Mormons were trying to do some political things and end up basically, how would you put it? They pretty much did not, they wore out their welcome, I guess is what you would say. They had come in the late 1830s. They had set up this city called Nauvoo, which Joseph Smith said meant the city beautiful. Basically had tried to take over in a political way. When Joseph Smith is killed, now the people want them out. And so they basically worked their way out of Illinois and headed toward Utah, which is where they were set up in 1847. So Illinois basically said that we wish that we would not have been so mean and kicked the Mormons out of Illinois. And so that's what they did last spring, is they came up with a resolution in the legislature, the state legislature, to say we apologize for anything that we might have done that caused harm to the Mormon Church.
Now, you put it in terms of them, the Mormons overstaying their welcome. What, as far as we can tell from the most accurate history, what were the concerns of the residents that led them to form this angry mob that eventually led to the death of Mormon Church founder Joseph Smith?
Well, there were a number of issues. I mean, it's hard to say one thing in general that would have been a cause. There would have been a number of things. The very thing that got Joseph Smith arrested in the first place that sent him to the Nauvoo jail was the fact that he destroyed the printing press of a newspaper called the Nauvoo Expositor. And this was put together by a group of people who were ex-Mormons who wanted to basically explain Joseph Smith was not telling the truth, he was not a true prophet, the problems with polygamy. This newspaper was a four-page newspaper in tabloid kind of a size, actually almost, well, it's a regular-sized newspaper, and it just basically exposed Mormonism, and Joseph Smith ordered that the printing press would be destroyed, and so it was. And the people were fed up with that because here he had come in, he had set up this Nauvoo, and he took over the political process He set up his own militia, and basically he was the king there, and there were assassinations that would take place, people would die. And in fact, if you go to Nauvoo today, there are actually grave sites there where people blame the Mormons for the deaths of their sons and their fathers and other relatives on the actual tombstones. I've seen that. And so there were a number of things that he kind of caused because of his power struggle, and he set up the Nauvoo militia, the Nauvoo Legion, which was a militia, and he had the biggest army in all of Illinois that he was able to control. And in those days, they were allowed to do that, but it got so powerful that it really made the United States government really nervous. And so there were just those kinds of things. The polygamy issue did not settle well with a lot of the residents. The idea that he wanted to be basically like a king in that area and be able to control, and it was an issue of control.
I always wonder about this, but if, for the sake of argument, if the LDS Church did not go on to become as large and as powerful as it has in the United States and elsewhere, and if we were simply looking back on a group of religious radicals making their way across the early United States, forming militias, declaring martial law,
mm-hmm.
Having murders attributed to their name, destruction of property, would we be looking back on this and saying, you know, we were a dangerous, dangerous group back there in the 1840s?
And it really was. In fact, the way I end my article, the last part there, the governor at the time, Governor Ford, said in 1846, he says, "It is with much satisfaction that I am enabled to state that the people called the Mormons have been removed." Now, that sounds really rough to us today because we're in the age of political correctness, and how dare us, because the Mormons are such nice people. And it's true. There are many nice Mormons out there. But when you look at the history of what actually was taking place back 170 years ago, 160 years ago, it was a lot different. In fact, Joseph Smith and Brigham Young both used a number of men for their dirty deeds. They had these guys who literally would do the dirty work, kill people, assassinate people, and get the job done. And in fact, one of the books that I recommend, if people want to get more information on the history of Mormonism, it's a book called One Nation Under Gods, and it's a history of the Mormon Church by Richard Aubonis, and I have it open in my lap right here, and on pages 209, 210, he talks about lawless Nauvoo and the things that created the atmosphere that it did, but the Mormon Church today seems so genteel, it seems such a nice organization, and so it just seems like, well, what's the big deal, it's an apology. And, you know, they're just trying to make things better, the Illinois state legislature. And here's my point. My point is this. Let's say you had been cut off by a Californian 3 years ago. And I don't know if that's occurred to you. Maybe I don't know if you've ever seen Californian drivers in your area of town. But let's say you had been. And I say to you, you know what? Because that's happened to you 3 years ago, I want to apologize. And you would say, well, that's nice, but you don't have the authority to apologize. And the reason why is because, number one, I didn't do it to you. Somebody else did. And I say, well, that was somebody from California, so I feel like I have a burden to apologize. We come into what really is true apology. Apology is when you really have done something and you need to get forgiveness for it. And in this situation, I don't think the state legislature should have made this apology, because if you look at the circumstances, and I'm not saying that people should go about persecuting people. Mormons, I think, did receive a lot of persecution. In fact, the Mormon Church itself will oftentimes rest in that fact and remind people we are a persecuted people. But that, to me, is beside the point that the state legislature should not have had the ability to say, we want to apologize, because probably most of the people in the state legislature and in the state of Illinois had nothing to do with it. I certainly had nothing to do with it. If I were living in Illinois, I would say, well, my relatives came from Germany and Norway. Why should I, as a state, say I'm sorry for something that we really don't have the right to do? Now, if the ancestors want to get together, who were part of the government at that time, I suppose maybe that would be more efficacious. But for me, I just don't understand why you would make an apology when you look at the history. And And Richard Abbanus does a really good job. He explains how armed mobs of Mormons would do damage to people, and Mormon thieves, he says, regularly stole from non-Mormons. This had been a long-standing complaint about saints in the area. 8 out of 14 issues of the Warsaw Signal, published between September 18, 1844, and January 1, 1845, included articles entitled Mormon Thieves, and for several weeks, beginning on Christmas Day, 1844, the publication ran stories about Mormon stealing. That's just part of this, and so you have to understand, these people kind of wore out their welcome, as they had done in Missouri a few years before, and so they had no alternative but to say, we really don't want you here anymore. You need to find a new place.
We're talking with Eric Johnson, associate with Mormonism Research Ministry, co-author of the book Mormonism 101, and he's author of a story in the Christian Research Journal titled Illinois Regrets Inhospitable Actions Against the Mormon Church. If you'd like to join us, our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. To clear this up so that we're... We did a show recently on an offshoot Mormon group that had been in, I think, Nevada. Now they're trying to move down to Texas. They're militant, openly militant. They're polygamous. They claim to be authentic, true Mormonism over against the LDS Church and others. And I wonder if they might not be true given what sounds like the militant history of original Mormonism.
Well, and we talked a little bit about that last time, too, very much so. When you look at what Mormonism was all about, Joseph Smith really did have an idea that he should be sort of like a king. In fact, when he was killed in 1844, he was running for president. He and Sidney Rigdon, it was the vice presidential nominee, and on his own party ticket, and he was trying to get this nomination because, in fact, if you go back to early Mormonism, and Richard Abbanus does a good job. I'm not pushing his book or anything, but he does a good job in his book trying to show how Mormons in the political process have been involved, because original Mormon teaching from Joseph Smith and Brigham Young said that the Mormons would take over in the end times and that they would take a political control in Washington. And I think Joseph Smith thought that he would be the one who would be the ruler. So, yes, these groups, such as the polygamous group you mentioned, the FLDS, and a number of other groups, very much believe that they are following true Mormonism, and especially with the polygamous groups, they feel that Mormonism, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Salt Lake City Church, which is the largest of the offshoots of Mormonism, with 12 million members, they honestly believe, each of these groups believe, that they are following true teaching, because the Mormon Church in 1890 went off the path.
Eric mentioned the book by Rich Abbanus, One Nation Under God's A History of the Mormon Church. Folks, it is a tremendous book. We've talked with Rich Abbanus about it before. I would say probably a definitive book of history on the Mormon Church, replete with primary sources as well. Tomorrow on the program, by the way, Rich Abbanus will be our guest to discuss his new book. It's called Becoming Gods. It's a closer look at 21st century Mormonism. That's tomorrow on the program. When we come back from this break, we'll continue our conversation with Eric Johnson, associate with Mormonism Research Ministry, about the resolution passed by the Illinois legislature in the spring that accepted blame for inhospitable actions taken against the Mormon people in the mid-19th century. Stay with us.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Scripture is filled, Old and New Testament, with prayers. What can we today learn about Christian prayer from the prayers of Holy Scripture? How did faithful men and women of the Old Testament pray when God seemed silent, when God seemed to have turned his back on them? You'll find answers to these questions in our Issues, Etc. book of the month for August, Is God Listening? By regular guest Dr. Andrew Steinman. You can find information on Is God Listening by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section. You'll find information on the book there. Or call Concordia Publishing House and order the book, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. The Issues, Etc. book of the month for August, Is God Listening? By Dr. Andrew Steinman, 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
6,000 languages, but only one source.
Answers with Ken Ham.
author of the anti-racism book, One Blood, The Biblical Answer to Racism. Well, Ken, has there been any secular research done on the origin of languages that somehow would support the Bible?
Well, there certainly has, but only the secular scientists won't admit it, of course. A recent study claimed there are around 6,000 languages spoken around the world today. It was stated that they must be descended from perhaps only one original tongue. The study goes on to say that the early languages were spread and scattered as people started to leave the one central area that was common to all. You know, this is exactly what the Bible says in Genesis chapter 11. This passage tells us that the people had one language, and that God confused the language of the people of Babel and scattered them abroad. Sadly, though, the language study follows secular dating methods of human history and puts a date for the one language somewhere between 20,000 and 50,000 years ago. But following the true account recorded in Genesis, we know that this actually took place a couple of hundred years after the flood, about 4,300 years ago. You see, the biblical account of Babel best explains this same evidence that the secular scientists are interpreting within an evolutionary framework. You see, the Bible's history is true.
That's the theme of Ken Ham's new booklet, The Bible is the True History Book of the Universe. Read the free booklet when you log on to AnswersRadio.com. AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Children surfing the net can accidentally come across sites that are racist, violent, or pornographic. Some sites will even bribe your child with the promise of free prizes in exchange for personal information. Some sites may even try to arrange personal meetings with your child. Software filters can be helpful in blocking out unwanted sites, but there is no substitute for keeping your home computer in a central location so you can easily monitor where your children are going online. Remember, God loves our children so much that He sent Jesus to die for them, and He also guards and protects them from sin and every evil. And one way He does that is through the watchful eyes of Christian parents. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Hi, this is Paul Clayton on behalf of Emma Wilkin, who brings you the Bible Brain Teaser for Kids Only. I'd like to invite you to our annual Kids Appreciation Day at Concordia Christian Books and Gifts inside the CPH building at South Jefferson and Miami and South St. Louis. It'll be a fun time between 9 and 11. Face painting, prizes, lots to eat, see, and do. It's the annual Kids Appreciation Day for all of you Bible Brain Teaser for Kids Only fans, Saturday, August 28th.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. 25 minutes left in the program today. Eric Johnson is still with us, associate with Mormonism Research Ministry, co-author of the book Mormonism 101, and author of a story in the Christian Research Journal titled Illinois Regrets Inhospitable Actions Against the Mormon Church, making reference to a resolution passed by the Illinois legislature in the spring that accepted blame for the inhospitable actions against Joseph Smith and his followers in the 1840s. And I did mention before the break that Rich Abanas, we've talked about his book several times here, he will be with us tomorrow to talk about 21st century Mormonism and his new book called Becoming Gods. Eric, what response, if any, from the LDS Church to the action of the Illinois legislature?
Well, they certainly received that with gladness. I have a Mormon friend of mine who made sure that I knew, see, they were wrong. What Illinois did, it's being recognized. See, this church is very much... It's powered by a public relations machine. Salt Lake City likes to have stories like this because it does show that the church had been persecuted, that now people are recognizing this. They like anything that makes the church look good in that sense, and we are such a fine church. We have Jesus Christ in our name. We are Christians. And to me, I think we're having problems understanding that Mormonism and Christianity are different because Mormonism denies or distorts every fundamental teaching of the historic Christian faith. And yet, here's the thing, they are going to try to water down those differences and make it look like we're just a nice organization. And I love Mormons. I think Mormons are great people, but I think there's a problem because we don't have the same faith. So a story like this makes it look like, you know, boy, they really were persecuted. They are good people. And why do you guys have such a hard time calling them your Christian brothers?
Well, the problem there, though, is, Eric, if they accept the apology of the Illinois legislature, it would follow that they also accept the circumstances under which the actions took place first. They would accept that Joseph Smith was attempting to become a quasi-military leader in Illinois, that he did have grand political aspirations, that he had destroyed property, that he and his people had made themselves a menace in the community.
Well, and the thing about history is if you can change history, then you can change the perception of people. And so most people are not well-read. They don't understand where Mormonism came from. And so if you don't know the history, and, you know, we don't have to talk about that issue, just the idea that it was against the Mormons. But once, like Richard Avanis, again, did a good job of uncovering the reality of what went on in those days, once you get yourself back in that time period, and that's the way history should be studied, then you say, well, wait a minute, now, and you read these pages of Avanis, Lawless Nauvoo, and there's a lot I could read in here, which I wouldn't do, but somebody who wants to go through here, you'd go, wait a minute. Well, let me just point out one thing. I was just looking through his story here. They had violent gangs of Mormons that included policemen, deacons, elders, and others in good standing in the church. They would be armed with 10 to 14-inch knives. Members of a roving band would assemble in groups of a dozen or more and surround a suspected dissenter or suspicious non-Mormon. They would then press in close to him and begin whittling while whittling in a menacing way. They would intimidate in that way. And another tactic they used, it was called Queen Peggy, or also known as Aunt Peggy, a euphemism for outhouse refuse. In those days, church enemies were smeared with excrement and latrine mud. The first unfortunate soul to endure Queen Peggy was Washington Peck, described by William Clayton as one of those mean traitors who lurks about continually in our midst, communicating with our enemies and seeking to have the 12 destroyed. And so they take him and they basically cover him in dung from this latrine. And, I mean, those were the things that were happening in those days. And so you got to know the history. The Mormon Church doesn't like to go back into history. And when you read a current issue of the Ensign, the Mormon publication, you're not going to get a history, but you're going to get a glorified history. And so where Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, they certainly had a lot of traits that you go, whoa, these guys were pretty tough guys, and they didn't mess around. But the way that you would read it in church publications, it's like going back 20 years ago into the Soviet Union and reading, I think they called it the Pravda. You know, you would read the newspaper, and the events would happen, but they would be reported in a completely different way.
Does the average Mormon person know this history about their church?
And that's a good question. No, I don't think so. I'm going to say most Mormons, they are very good at their education, but they educate them in the way that they want them to be educated. So the kids growing up in their primary, they call it, in the Sunday schools, they learn the basic ideas of Mormon history. They glorify the Mormon history. And when the kids are in high school, they go through the Bible and the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine and Covenant and church history. They go to the ward, they call it, before school every day. They do that, I'm sure, in St. Louis. You'll go to drive by a ward at 6 o'clock in the morning, and you'll see cars there because they're teaching these kids. And then when they're 19, if they're male, they're going to go to become missionaries. They learn all of that there. So they're not going to get a good understanding of history from a neutral point, or they want to call it an anti-Mormon point, like a Richard Avanis. They probably would not believe him. But like you mentioned earlier, a guy like that, and there are other books, too, that are fully documented. Everything is there to be read, but people oftentimes are scared to look, they're too lazy to look, whatever the reason. And I'm going to suggest that's a problem the Mormon Church has run into in the last 10 years with the advent of the Internet. Now, this is really causing some problems, and in fact, their total membership, their increase in membership is going, in fact, last year it was the lowest in 10 years. I think the population, the converts were 249,000 or something in that neighborhood. Well, it was just 10 years ago, they were in the 340s. They were getting 100,000 more converts. What's going on? They have 60,000 missionaries out there compared to 45,000 10 years ago. And the thing is, I think potential converts are going onto the Internet, and they're looking in the bookstores, and they're looking at this, and they're saying, wait a minute here. I thought they said this was Christian, but this isn't Christian, because you have websites like Gerald and Sandra Tanner's and Mormonism Research Ministries and others out there. You type into Google Mormonism, and our website, MRM.org, is like number two when you type that in. And so, you know, this means that there are a lot of people who are searching out what does Mormonism teach? What do Jehovah's Witnesses teach? These different groups out there, and they're getting educated.
Folks, if you would like to visit the website for Mormonism Research Ministry, and I suggest you do, especially if you've been approached by a couple Mormon elders and they're talking to you about joining up, go there, wmrm.org. It's www.mrm.org. And Eric Johnson is associate with Mormon Research Ministry. He's co-author of the book Mormonism 101, and he has written this story for the Christian Research Journal, Illinois Regrets Inhospitable Actions Against the Mormon Church. Eric Johnson, thank you for being our guest.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Does God answer the prayer of the Mormon when the Mormon prays? They do pray, you know. And if they are denying, as Eric so rightly pointed out, every cardinal doctrine of the Christian faith, is God listening to their prayers? Why does God hear the Christian's prayer? God hears our prayers for one and one reason only, and that is because of Jesus Christ's death on the cross for us. That's the only reason God listens to prayer, and prayer prayed apart from faith in that, if that is a distorted prayer, the Mormon or a non-Christian, is not heard, because God hears and answers prayer only for the sake of his Son, Jesus Christ. It's one of the central truths of our Issues Etc. book of the month for August, Is God Listening? It's written by a regular guest here on Issues Etc., Dr. Andrew Steinman. It's about Christian prayer. You can order Is God Listening by calling Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues Etc. book of the month for August, Is God Listening? 1-800-325-3040. You can also visit one of the two locations that they have here in St. Louis where they operate bookstores, one at 3558 South Jefferson in St. Louis. When you go in, mention Issues Etc., or here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton, 801 DeMunn in Clayton. Again, mention Issues Etc. when you ask for the Issues Etc. book of the month for August, Is God Listening? You can also browse before you buy. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section. The book is called Is God Listening by Dr. Andrew Steinman. For the remainder of this hour, you might have seen these driving around. I haven't yet. Box trucks driving around St. Louis with pictures of aborted babies. Stephanie Gray joins us, media spokesman for the Center for Bioethical Reform. They are behind this pro-life caravan called the Key States Initiative. We're going to find out what it's all about for the last few minutes of Issues, etc. If you would like to join us with a question or a comment, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Stephanie, welcome to Issues, etc.
Thank you very much, Todd.
First of all, tell us about Key States Initiative, if you would.
Sure. This is a nationwide campaign that began in February in Florida and will end in November in Washington State. And we're basically going to 22 of the states that have been identified as swing states in this election and where the candidates will be spending most of their time. We want to raise the issue of abortion as one of extreme importance in this election. We want voters to be aware of what's going on behind clinic doors so that this is an issue of concern to them. And we believe because we're living in a visual culture, pictures are a powerful medium to convey our message to the public at large, and so we have put very graphic images of aborted babies on the sides of very large trucks, and we're driving the trucks across the country.
Now, beyond the appeal to the visual, which is obvious, you know, people do just buy what they see, and the image does have an impact. Why do you think it's effective to have graphic images pertaining to abortion but in the public eye?
Right. Well, BBT believes that there is a lot of ignorance in the public at large about who that unborn baby is and what abortion does to the baby. And people, not only do they not know that information, they don't want to know more. And so we have to meet people where they're at because large numbers of them won't come out of their way to presentations and other seminars. And so we've designed this project to go to the most populated areas. And in our experience, we found that when some women who are seriously considering abortion see these images, they opt not to go ahead with killing their baby. And we receive emails from women all over the world who have encountered our images on the website and other locations and have told us that.
Some might say that you're crossing a line. It's one thing to post these on a website where people can go by choice. It's another thing to have to see them involuntarily if you're driving down the highway on your way to work. How do you respond?
Well, a response is that that's the whole point, is people, if we have the pictures in an area where people have to go out of their way to view them, they won't view them. A culture that is complicit with the death of 4,000 children every day often does not want to voluntarily become aware of that fact. So in a sense, we need to force feed the facts upon the culture in the same way that any social reform movement throughout history that has been successful has also had to force feed facts upon a culture. Civil rights activists knew that there would be no social reform if they stayed in the comfort of the pews of black churches and invited moderates or somewhat racist individuals to come to the church and hear a message. They knew that that wouldn't work, that instead they had to leave the churches and go to the whites-only lunch counters or do their marches in the streets and force a culture to face an injustice. And in the same way, we are meeting people where they're at, knowing they won't in large numbers come out of their way to us.
Now, one of the other things you're attempting to do is essentially redefine the political debate and redefine the labels that are often put upon pro-life people. They're often referred to as moderates or centrists when people who are pro-choice, whereas people who are pro-life are called extreme or radical. How does the image in front of the public eye help redefine the terms of the debate?
Right. Well, what we're showing is that what's really extreme is killing babies. So people who are quote-unquote pro-choice and try to make themselves look like they sit in the middle, they're very clearly taking a side, and that's the side in support of killing innocent human beings. And we believe when people see the pictures, they will realize the good position is the pro-life one, and the extreme position to resist is the one that supports abortion.
Are you concerned about young children seeing these pictures?
Yes, we're definitely not targeting young children. We are targeting, you know, people who are old enough to have abortions because we believe then they're old enough to see them. But we recognize there's little to no area we can go in which no children will ever be present. And so because some children may be exposed to the images, we tell parents if they want, they can practice parental discretion and distract the child, or two, seize it as a teaching opportunity. In our experience, we have found that the parent's reaction determines the child's reaction. An angry, swearing, irate parent will have a confused child, but a calm parent who gently explains that bad things happen and there were some little babies that have been hurt, but the little child doesn't need to worry because they're already born and they're not going to be targeted for abortion, and that the people driving the trucks don't want any more babies to be hurt, and that's why they're out here, then you will have a calm child that can, you know, go on with the rest of the day.
We're talking with Stephanie Gray. She's media spokesman for the Center for Bioethical Reform. CBR is sponsoring this pro-life caravan called Key States Initiative. Box trucks driving around the St. Louis area and elsewhere with pictures of aborted babies on them. Let's go to the phones at 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. Bob is calling from his car. Bob, welcome.
Yes, a couple of days ago you were talking about stem cell research and embryos in petri dishes. If you took a photograph of that, you wouldn't have the image of anything that looks like a baby. Does that mean that because it doesn't look like a baby, we're not supposed to be concerned about the embryo in the petri dish?
No. Thanks for your question, Bob. We, of course, believe life begins at fertilization, and therefore anything which takes that life from fertilization onwards, whether it's abortifacient birth control, embryonic stem cell research, cloning, or abortion as we typically understand it in surgical procedures, would all be wrong. The reason that we're using these pictures is because when we're talking about surgical abortion, which is happening 4,000 times each day in America, that's typically the end result. The majority of abortions happen in the first trimester, around the time where we have the images, 8, 9, 10, 11 weeks. So our use of the first trimester image isn't to exclude the very early first trimester baby, you know, at 1 or 2 days after fertilization, but because that's when the vast majority of surgical abortions occur, we're relying on those pictures.
How would you respond to someone who says, look, I'm opposed to abortion, but what you're doing is simply going too far?
Well, we say what's going too far, showing the pictures of abortion or abortion itself. And what's really going too far is that the American people are permitting the killing of over 1 million babies each year in our own backyard. And, you know, we frequently see images of atrocities in the third world and other places, And as bad as those things are, we seem to forget that we're also doing our own bad things right in our own backyard. And people who are shocked and disgusted by the images should be shocked and disgusted, because abortion is shocking and abortion is disgusting. And what's also disgusting is the apathy which is permitting the death of these innocent human beings.
There's a billboard here in St. Louis, and it may be in more than one location, but it's in my path. It shows a in utero baby, probably, I would say, early, first trimester. And it's, I think the slogan is something like, "Who am I? I am an American. Protect me," or something like that.
Mm.
Why not show the in utero baby, the still healthy, still alive in utero baby, to illustrate the same point?
Right. We encourage the use of fetal development photos. The approach we're taking, we don't believe, is the only approach to take, but we do believe it is a necessary one, even though there are many other avenues that can be used. Fetal development photos, facts about the growth of that baby very early, you know, the heart starts beating at 21 days. That's all important to convey to the public. But in the same sense, just as pictures of the Holocaust, during the Holocaust when Jews' bodies were piled high after being killed, just as those images are more gripping than images of happy, smiling Jewish people and saying, "Look at who we lost," in the same sense, the graphic abortion photos can be more gripping than the positive fetal development photos. It's not to say it should be one or the other. Our approach would be to say, let's use both.
Ann is calling from Crestwood. Ann, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Oh, good afternoon. I have a huge list from Missouri Right to Life of organizations that support the use of fetal tissue in their research. And I know I get phone calls daily asking for money for American Cancer Society or something like that. It's very wise to know which organizations you don't want to contribute to anymore, because they are supporting the use of fetal tissue in their research. And if you call Missouri Right to Life, they will send you a copy of these.
Ann, thank you very much. We appreciate that contribution to the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Any response there, Stephanie?
Well, yeah, I think that's a very excellent point. Tragically, there's a lot of bad things happening with regards to harming the unborn, whether it's through abortion or whether it's through research in which we're killing these babies to try to benefit us. And to me, that's no different from doing experiments on Jews to try to benefit the Nazis. So it's important that if there are organizations that are doing things that involve the use of embryos and fetuses and their tissues, we must say to those organizations, I won't give you money until you stop supporting those bad causes. Even if the organization is doing something good, if they're doing something bad to get to their good end, we can't support that.
Some might say that abortion is simply a personal issue. And they'll say, look, okay, I'm personally opposed to it, but I can't impose that on someone else.
Mm, yes. A very common sentiment that I hear a lot, particularly on university campuses. And that's really flawed thinking, because if you were to say to an individual, are you opposed to slavery? And they would say yes. And you say, you're personally opposed. You would never yourself own a slave. They would say, absolutely, I think it would be wrong for me to own a slave. Then you could say to them, imagine saying, I am personally opposed to slavery, but I feel I can't enforce my views on others. Therefore, if my neighbor wants to own a slave, that's his right. Of course, that would be a ridiculous statement, because the reason that you yourself would oppose slavery is because it harms an innocent human being. And not only would it be wrong for you to harm an innocent human being, but it would be wrong for others to do so. And so when people in our culture talk about being personally opposed to abortion, it's likely because they themselves feel it would be wrong to kill that innocent human being. Well, if it's wrong for them to kill an innocent human being, surely it's going to be wrong for the rest of society as well.
I'm picturing the person who is strongly pro-choice, the person who's driving down the highway with the "I'm pro-choice and I vote," the if you don't like abortion, don't have one bumper stickers.
Right.
And pro-choice and proud of it, things like that. They see these pictures and they are simply infuriated. Does that further the cause?
Well, you know, we never know how God will work in the hearts of people. And sometimes the people that are the most infuriated will go through beautiful conversions, because when we are bothered by something, when we're confused, when we're forced to ask questions, we investigate an issue. We can't get it out of our head. And God can work that into a wonderful thing. And I'll briefly tell you, about 5 years ago, our organization did a pro-life exhibit at the University of Oregon. And we used graphic pictures, and it was so controversial that pro-abortion students came up and circled the display with huge bed sheets trying to prevent it from being seen. And only a few months ago, we received an email from one of the students that was at that university. And she said, "I was looking at the pictures on your website from when you were at the University of Oregon, and I came across the worst thing I've ever seen myself. There I am standing, holding up bed sheets, trying to cover up the blood that was on my hands. I just wanted to tell you I'm sorry. Since you came to the University of Oregon, I have converted to traditional Catholicism, I have repented of my sins, and I now volunteer at a crisis pregnancy center and to do a candlelight vigil outside of Planned Parenthood. If you're ever at the University of Oregon again, let me know. I'd love to help." There is someone who was so hostile to our message that she was doing everything she could to cover it up. But God worked in her heart, and 5 years later, she reported the beautiful things God had done through her.
Stephanie, a couple of final questions very quickly. Have you tried to produce or place television commercials of this nature?
We know that we can't get these images on TV in the form that they're in. It's very rare, even with our news coverage, that they will show the trucks with the full image. Often they blur them or they just show the portion of the truck which says the word choice. So we are doing this precisely because it's the last mass media venue we have left.
Do Americans, and you've mentioned the complicity that is at work here with 4,000 deaths a day, do Americans really want to see the reality of abortion?
Tragically, they don't want to, but I think in the long run they will, when they come to the realization of how much harm abortion is doing, not only with the mass loss of life, but with the negative physical and emotional and spiritual effects it's having on women. Ultimately, they're going to want to know so that we can rectify these wrongs and make some positive changes. You know, people are often saying, how come we haven't found the cure for AIDS or the cure for cancer? Where is world peace? You know, maybe we have killed the very individuals that were going to bring about the cure for cancer or world peace, and maybe we killed them through abortion. So there's a lot of bad things that have happened through abortion, and even if Americans don't want to know the truth right now, in the long run, it's a benefit to them.
Stephanie Gray is media spokesperson for the Center for Bioethical Reform. CBR is sponsoring this pro-life caravan called the Key States Initiative. Their website, abortionno.com. Yes, Stephanie?
I believe .com probably works. It's also .org.
All right, abortionno.org. Stephanie, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you very much.
Oh, we've only got a few seconds here. Tonight, from 8 to 9 here on AM 850, tune in for the first hour of the show. Jennifer Roback Morse was our guest. We talked about staying informed in an information age. Look for those trucks with the pictures, and when you pass them, give them the thumbs up. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.